Suspense.
I feel no longer any fear or even sorrow. Only a desire that the end and the thing that I must do may come soon. And it will be soon, I know. Yes. For there is someone at the door.
In the garage of Dr. Frank Conrad, on November 2nd, 1920, the first scheduled pre-advertised radio program in the United States went on the air. Station KDKA was broadcasting returns of the presidential race on the evening of Election Day. From a humble beginning in a Pittsburgh garage to the sumptuous studios of the national radio networks in New York, Chicago, and Hollywood, these are the years we refer to as the Golden Age of Radio.
Here's the Manhattan merry-go-round that brings you the bright side of life, that whirls you in music to all the big night spots of New York town, to hear the top songs of the week sung so clearly you can understand every word in singing your
time. Al Kemp on the air for Griffin.
Time to shine, shine your shoes
and Rogers in the 25th century.
Ah, don't touch that dial.
Tonight's program is brought to you by Hotel Sinesta at Constitution Plaza in Hartford, Connecticut. Here to share this evening of memories with me is James Ballard, general manager of the Hotel Sinesta. Well, Jim, you and I are in for a treat this evening. Do you remember listening to radio as a youngster?
I do, Dick, very much so.
What are your fondest memories?
Well, one of my fondest memories is the program Lorenzo Jones and His Wife, Belle.
Yes, I recall. And do you remember the many inventions that Lorenzo came up with?
I sure do.
Do you remember Suspense by any chance?
Yes.
Well, tonight's show concerns Suspense, and our guest is its producer and director. And we'll meet him in just a moment. But first of all, I want to remind our listeners, in case they haven't made plans tomorrow, Jim, that Thanksgiving dinner will be available at the Rib Room. How many seatings do you plan on?
We plan on 5 seatings tomorrow, Dick, at 12 noon, 2, 4, 6 p.m., and 8 p.m. tomorrow evening.
And I suppose it will be the traditional Thanksgiving dinner, will it?
Yes, it will. It'll be the Thanksgiving dinner that we've presented for the last 5 years.
Can you give me an idea of the menu?
Yes, there'll be turkey. There'll be also our specialty clam pie as an appetizer. We'll have clam chowder. We'll be serving our delicious roast beef. We'll have available Cornish hen. And for dessert, some of the old favorites, the mince pie, the pumpkin pie, should be just really festive and delightful.
And, of course, that's tomorrow. 12, 2, 4, 6, and 8 are the seatings. Reservations are recommended, are they?
They are.
And you can call tonight until 10 o'clock or tomorrow, of course.
That's correct. Call directly to the hotel. Ask for the Rib Room, Mr. Klaus.
That's the Rib Room of the Hotel Sinesta here in downtown Hartford. Jim, are you all set for tonight's program?
I am, Dick.
Well, then let's meet the man with 2,000 hours of old-time radio memories on tape, Mr. Ed Corcoran. How are you tonight, Ed?
Very good, Dick. It's nice to be here again with you.
Well, our program is originating not from our studios tonight, but from the home of our guest in Weston, Connecticut. And perhaps you might tell us just a bit about our guest before we meet him.
Well, to the radio buff, the man's name is a household word, and he was associated with many famous shows. In fact, to introduce him properly, why don't we play one of his shows, Dick, and actually hear how he was introduced on the air.
And now, Roma Wines, R-O-M-A, Roma Wines, present Suspense. Tonight, Roma Wines bring you Robert Taylor in The House in Cypress Canyon, a suspense play produced, edited, and directed for Roma Wines by William Spear. Suspense.
Well, I think people certainly remember that show, Ed, and I'm sure they're ready to meet our guest now. We're talking, of course, about William Spear, the producer, director, and editor of suspense. Bill, it's a pleasure to be able to share this microphone with you here in the golden age of radio.
Well, thank you, Dick. It's wonderful, and I'm looking forward to talking about it.
I know, and your career goes back really to the 20s. I didn't realize that you entered the field of radio so early. How did it happen?
Yes, of course, I was only 1 year old, actually, in 1929. I wasn't too terribly much older than that. I was a music critic. Music is what I really started out to be, and what I think I still know best, although I've gotten away with, excuse the expression, murder. But in 1929, my brother, who was very much older than I, was copy chief at Batten, Barton, Durston, and Osborne, the great advertising agency in New York. And the agency had just signed up. These were the very new days, please remember, of radio. It was a very, very new medium. But in those days, BBDNO, to shorten it, had inveigled the Metropolitan Opera Company into signing up an exclusive contract with the agency to use its artists. And Roy Durston, the vice president of the agency, was having lunch with my brother and said that he had now done this great thing, but now he was suddenly confronted by the problem of making programs that would fit into an hour, and that nobody could understand, nobody knew enough about the opera lingo, and how long was Una Furtiva Lagrima from L'Elisa d'Amore, or what was this thing from, was that a fast or a slow one from Rigoletto, and Tristan and Isolde was probably too heavy, and he needed somebody to arrange programs with the conductors and with the singers and with the artists. And my brother said, well, my kid brother, meaning me, Bill, who was a music critic at Musical America magazine, getting, I think I was up to $32.50 a week, you know, which was high living in 1929, said he knows everything about music and maybe he'd be your man. So we had lunch, and anyway, I got lured into radio and never to quit until I came east some years ago.
But of course, you were in the musical end of radio, and at the time that you entered the field, this was basically the fare that radio had to offer, wasn't it?
Very true, almost entirely. There were a few little 15-minute things, the Snow Village sketches, and little homey things, and there were a few light-hearted little things. But that serious drama had not yet happened, and even comedians doing things that later on the Jack Bennies and the Fred Allens did with such success had been tried vaguely, abortively, but hadn't lasted. And it had mostly come down to a popular show with Ruth Etting, or one of the stars of the time, or a small dance band, or a larger popular music, or in the case of Atwater Kent Radio, which I was involved with, and General Motors, the Metropolitan Opera people and an orchestra playing fairly light, short pieces. Nothing went over 3 minutes long.
Did you have a feeling for drama? Did you have an interest in it even then?
Yes, I did. I had always been as Jimmy Durante says, a carnivorous reader, but hadn't had much chance to use this until later on when they had a big meeting with Time magazine, who was one of the clients at BBDNO. And somebody said, what do you think Time magazine should put on the air if they were going to do a radio show? And I heard myself and somebody else echoing it. I think we both said it at the same time. I've forgotten who. Said, dramatize the news. And so we invented a show called The March of Time, in which we simulated the voices of the famous people.
You said something interesting, Bill, and I think we should explore it further for the benefit of our audience who may not remember the March of Time. You said the simulated voices.
Mm-hmm.
Now, why were they simulated?
Well, we were dramatizing the news. We could, by listening to radio broadcasts, do a very close job of simulating the characteristics of Mahatma Gandhi, mm-hmm. of Hitler, of George V, of Franklin D. Roosevelt.
This, of course, was before the days of so-called actualities, when you could really record the voices of people. This is, I'm sure, what the younger members of our audience don't seem to understand. You didn't have the flexibility then with tape that you have today.
There were no second chances about it. That is quite true. The March of Time was an extremely wonderful proving ground. I learned so much about all kinds of things. We used music, sound effects. We invented things like the echo chamber and the stream of consciousness. All of these techniques, I believe, came to an early fruition in the efforts of the March of Time. And it was a difficult show, terribly difficult, a murderous show physically, because we would do the show on a Thursday night, and all Wednesday night you'd be up all night rewriting what had happened to replace what you had already thought was going to happen on Tuesday. Remember, this were the days when Roosevelt was just coming in, when it would be on the gold standard on Tuesday and would be offered on Wednesday, or an assassination attempt would happen on Wednesday night at 8:30, or the Hindenburg disaster, which happened right over our heads. We all stood out there. I remember we were taking 10 minutes off to have a sandwich or something at that night after having been up two nights without sleep. And this marvelous Zeppelin, the German Zeppelin, came over to land at Lakehurst, New Jersey. Mm-hmm. And we all said, my golly, what a wonderful, indestructible-looking thing that is. And 20 minutes later, they were on the phone telling us the thing had blown up, had exploded. People were being thrown about and dying. And we got on the air in that 20 minutes, wrote an act. We used to call them acts, these separate segments of the show, and reproduced and simulated the effects and the last words and the screaming of those people.
That's an unbelievable feat. I wonder if radio is flexible enough to do that today.
Well, I don't know. It took a fairly good sized staff and a lot of alert people and a lot of news conscious people.
Ed, do you and your vast collection, do you have a March of Time?
Matter of fact, I do, Dick. Maybe we ought to play one for our audience so they can hear for themselves what a great show this really was.
The March of Time. Tonight, the editors of Time, the weekly news magazine, raise the curtain again on their new kind of reporting of the news. The reenacting of memorable scenes from the news of the week, from the March of Time. 1934 marches on. The Bronx, New York.
Bruno Richard Hauptmann, you are indicted for extortion, suspected of kidnapping and murder.
I am innocent.
For 2 years, an aroused nation has sought the kidnapper and murderer of Charles Augustus Lindbergh, Jr. Then a fortnight ago, Bronx police arrest Bruno Richard Hauptmann, carpenter, one-time German machine gunner. Bronx County indicts him for the extortion of the $50,000 Lindbergh ransom. But still the state of New Jersey and the nation wonder, does the evidence prove Hauptmann committed the kidnapping and murder?
The handwriting on the first ransom note, left on the windowsill of the baby's room the night of the kidnapping, has been identified in the criminal laboratories of the Department of Justice as your handwriting.
I do not know anything about it.
In your house was found a German-American dictionary with the pages turned down where appeared the most difficult words in that note found on the crib.
I am innocent.
The ladder used to enter the Lindbergh nursery was constructed from lumber taken from a lumber yard in which you once worked.
I do not know. I was never in Hopewell.
A cake of nails exactly like those which held the ladder together was found buried in the earth of your garage.
I know nothing about it.
It is believed that the person on that ladder wrenched his leg when it broke. You limped on a bad leg all the summer after the kidnapping.
It is varicose veins I had.
Your footprints correspond to the imprints left beneath the baby's window that night.
I am innocent. I know nothing about that.
On the night of the kidnapping, did you meet a man named William C. Dennis on a road near Hopewell? And did you borrow from him a tire pump? That man claims you did, Bruno Hauptmann.
I never saw him.
A chisel found near the Lindbergh home bears the same trademark as the tools found in your garage.
I know nothing about it.
Bruno Richard Hauptmann, in a trunk in your house was found a detailed roadmap of the country around Hopewell.
I know nothing about it.
Do you know, Bruno Hauptmann, that whoever received the ransom money identified himself by two special pins taken from the baby's crib and a child's blue sleeping suit? Do you know that $49,000 out of the $50,000 of ransom money have been traced to you?
The man Fish, who died in Germany, gave me the money. I am not guilty. I will be able to explain everything. I know nothing at all about the Lindbergh kidnapping. I am a decent man. I ask the world to withhold its judgment until the case is over.
Unbroken by 16 days of grueling examination, undaunted by circumstantial evidence which draws tighter and tighter around him its accusing web of fact, Bruno Richard Hauptmann stubbornly reiterates his innocence. As a now bewildered nation watches the law's battle against his armor of silence, the New York Law Journal pronounces,
before Hauptmann can be convicted of kidnapping and murder, many links in the chain of evidence against him are still to be forged. Lacking a confession or betrayal by an accomplice, the only crime concerning which proof is apparently complete is an offense with which he is not likely to be charged, that of hoarding gold.
Time marches on. Tonight, the editors of Time, the weekly news magazine, have selected, dramatized 8 scenes from the news of the week, from the 135 news stories in the current issue of Time. Time is the one and only complete record of this swift-changing civilization. 475,000 Americans have now discovered Time. It's the magazine with the red border and the portrait of the week's news headliner on its cover. For all the news of all the world, read Time. Time marches on.
The March of Time, created and produced by William Spear, our guest tonight. We'll return to our conversation with William Spear in just a moment, but first let's say hello again to Jim Ballard, General Manager of Hotel Sonesta, sponsors of this evening's Golden Age of Radio. Jim, did you ever realize that such drama was produced on radio in the 30s?
I didn't realize it, Dick.
I think it's a surprise to a lot of our listeners tonight. We have drama here in Hartford, in the form of the Hartford Stage Company, of course. And you have an exciting pre-theater dinner menu now being offered at the Rib Room, don't you?
Yes, we do. And it really is no suspense.
Well, tell me about it. I know that it includes parking, first of all, so let's begin right there.
Yes, it does include parking, Dick. One can drive to the hotel. The doorman will take the car, proceed to the Rib Room, where we have a pre-theater dinner, which consists of a four-course dinner, soup, appetizer, entree, dessert, for $4.50. This is served every night in the Rib Room, with the exception of Sundays and Mondays.
Of course, one of the problems in having dinner before going to the theater is making sure that you meet the curtain. Is this taken care of at the Rib Room?
Yes, it is. Parties arriving 1 hour before curtain time are guaranteed to be out of the Rib Room and to the stage before curtain.
It's a good idea, of course, to make reservations.
It is.
Then by all means do so at the Rib Room of the Hotel Sonesta for your pre-theater dinner. And now, Jim, let's get back to our guest, William Spear, the producer of Suspense.
Fine.
Well, Bill, when did Suspense go on the air, and were you involved with it from the very first?
I was not involved from the very first. The show was conceived by Charles Vanda, V-A-N-D-A, a very wonderful producer and great old friend, in California. And it came about in 1940 as part of a series called Forecast, which CBS put on in the summer as a replacement for the Lux Radio Theater, which used to play 46 weeks a year, but took an 8-week hiatus. And up until then, they had just filled the show with anything that the network could find. But we came up with the idea of using that 8 weeks as a testing ground, a pilot, it would be called today, a ground for new shows, one of which was Suspense, another was Duffy's Tavern, and several shows were sold and went on into getting well-known in radio. Some others fell by the wayside.
Now, there were many programs that might be considered mystery or horror programs, but Suspense seemed to be a part.
I grew up in the tradition of Arthur Conan Doyle and H. Rider Haggard, if you will, and all of the romantic, how will it come out, can she get away by midnight, people, rather than the clanking chains of the purely ghost story. Not that Suspense doesn't sometimes have an element of horror, or that horror doesn't have an element of suspense. But I did not specialize in the clanking chains.
Well, just looking at the show in retrospect, how did the theme come about? Rather unique theme. Was that something that you had a personal hand in, or how did that evolve?
The theme was written by Bernard Herrmann. He was a wonderful composer and a great, great guy, and the husband, at the time anyway, of Lucille Fletcher, who wrote Sorry, Wrong Number, and many of the shows that we did that were superior things. No, that was part of Charlie Vanda's original show, too. I invented the phrase, tale well calculated to keep you in suspense.
We're visiting at the home of William Speer here in Weston, Connecticut tonight for our Golden Age of Radio broadcast. And, Ed, from your collection, I know that a great many Hollywood stars were on the suspense series.
Yes, I think that probably more than any other, with the exception of the Lux Radio Theater. In fact, it did come in cycles, didn't it, Bill? You had sometimes a group of Hollywood stars, and then other times you would feature very famous radio stars. But I think the Hollywood end was probably the most interesting.
I was very proud always that suspense was able to corral the really distinguished actors from both sides of the country. And while it was in Hollywood, we had people like Cary Grant and Jimmy Stewart, and Olivia de Havilland and Betty Davis and everyone. I can't think of hardly anyone of note, very few anyway, who were not a part of it. I never showed anyone in my life. I have never given a script to anyone for approval. I don't believe in it. They would do it because they were able to play things that they couldn't play any other way. Jimmy yeah. Stewart would be a murderer, or Jack Benny, mm-hmm. a murderer, mm-hmm. or Edward G. Robinson would be totally innocent, or Boris Karloff would turn out to be completely wronged, or Peter Lorre. And this was not always true, but there was the chance always for that variation in their lives, which hadn't existed before.
Yes. A new dimension in their career, really.
Yes.
You mentioned a show, Bill, which obviously must be one of your favorites, which featured Ronald Colman.
August Heat.
Yes, he was another great voice.
That magnificent, wonderful quality of voice and elegance and manner. I think there was never a man that I knew of, certainly myself, that would have asked who would you most like to be if you could get started again, would be Ronald Colman. The August Heat that he did, I think we did it four or five times. It got to be pretty nearly an annual event. And it was a special beauty about it. That was a show with just three men in it and sound effects and music. And there again, the one and only Lud Gluskin, who conducted, and his wonderful composers, Lucian Morawieck and Bernard Herrmann and others, were greatly responsible for the impact of those shows, creating of a spell of loneliness or of awe or of majesty or of what? Because the narrative principle was so much in use in a show like Suspense.
August Heat with Ronald Colman.
Let me say at the outset that my name is James Clarence Withencroft. I'm 40 years old, in perfect health, never having known a day's illness. By profession, I am an artist. Not a very successful one, but I earn enough money by my black and white work to satisfy my necessary wants. My only near relative, a sister, died 5 years ago, so that there is no one in particular to whom I address this manuscript. Only you, who might by chance read it someday. For, because of the peculiar circumstance about which you will soon hear, I have the strong premonition that I shall never live to tell anyone about it. I breakfasted this morning at 9 at the usual time. It was no different from any other morning. And after glancing through the morning paper, I lighted my pipe, and I proceeded to let my mind wander in the hope that I might chance upon some subject for my pencil. The room, though door and window were open, was oppressively hot, and I had just made up my mind that the coolest and most comfortable place in the neighborhood would be the deep end of the public swimming bath when I was suddenly shaken A feeling swept over me such as I had never experienced before. I attempted to rise to my feet, but somehow it seemed as though I had suddenly been fastened to my chair. My hand went out in an effort to brace myself. And then, before I knew what I was doing, my pencil was in my hand, and I began to draw. It was as though someone had taken my hand and was moving it across the paper, swiftly, in bold strokes. And then I seemed to take over. My hand, under its own power, began to draw. I soon forgot the oppressive heat. Everything was forgotten in this frantic feeling that the sketch must be finished as soon as possible. Now, for the first time since I'd begun, I actually seemed to see what I had been sketching. I was surprised. The final result was, I felt sure, the best thing I'd ever done. It showed a criminal in the dock, immediately after the judge had pronounced sentence. The man was fat, enormously fat. He stood there before the judge, his short, clumsy fingers clasping the rail, looking straight in front of him. The feeling that his expression conveyed was not so much one of horror as of utter, absolute collapse. There seemed nothing in the man strong enough to sustain that mountain of flesh. And then I saw that the sketch wasn't complete, for the man's other hand seemed to be clutching an instrument of some kind, a weapon, but it hadn't been completed. I had made this sketch, and yet I had no recollection of what I'd intended the man to carry in his other hand. I took up my pencil again, and I attempted to fill in the fuzzy outline, but it was useless. It was as though my fingers had suddenly turned to lead. I sat down, and I felt the moisture slowly forming on my forehead. And once again, I was conscious of the oppressive heat. Then I knew that there would be no finishing of the sketch, at any rate not for the moment. So I rolled it up, and without quite knowing why, I put it in my pocket. I believe that I set out with the idea of calling upon Trenton, for I remember walking along Lytton Street and turning to the right along Gilchrist Road at the bottom of the hill where the men are at work on the new tram line. From there onwards, I have only the vaguest recollection of where I went. Through parks, along crowded streets, always conscious of the awful heat that came up from the dusty asphalt pavement in a suffocating wave. Too, the hollow sound of my footsteps as I moved along. Although walking aimlessly, I somehow knew that there was a goal, a something to which I was drawn. I longed for the thunder promised by the great banks of copper-colored clouds that hung low over the western sky. I began to take stock of my bearings. I found myself standing before a gate that led into a yard bordered by a strip of thirsty earth. There were flowers, purple stock and scarlet geranium, and great numbers of bees droned over them. I stood looking down at them for a moment, and then, for some reason, I looked up. Over the entrance to the place, there was a board with the inscription, Charles Atkinson, Monumental Mason, worker in English and Italian marbles. Itself came a cheery whistle, the noise of hammer blows, and the cold sound of steel meeting stone. A sudden impulse made me enter, and I went in the direction of the noise. There was a man, sitting with his back towards me. He was busy at work on a slab of curiously veined marble. Then, without turning, his hammer stopped in midair as he was about to bring it down on his chisel. He held this position a moment before turning, but I knew that he was aware of my presence, and when he turned, I saw his face. It was, although I'd never seen him before, It was the face of the man I had been drawing.
That's a frightening story. August Heat, starring Ronald Coleman. We'll return to our guest this evening, William Spear, producer of Suspense, in just a moment. We're talking with Jim Ballard, general manager of Hotel Sonesta at Constitution Plaza here in Hartford. Jim, let's take the family out for a Sunday dinner at the Rib Room, shall we?
I'd like to.
All right. What do we offer?
We offer complete dinners for the family, fixed price as opposed to a la carte. And we have a special treat for the children, for all children, a coloring book of Hotel Sonesta and crayons to keep them busy during dinner.
I'm sure you're aware of this. It's a problem taking the youngsters out to dinner because their attention span, of course, isn't as long as that of an adult, and this is a problem which is solved very nicely at the Rib Room. Yet the adults can enjoy the sophistication and the glamour of the Rib Room at the same time.
Yes, and of a family setting, because we really are featuring a family dinner.
You're serving family style, incidentally?
Yes.
All right, then, by all means, visit the Rib Room this Sunday. Enjoy family dinner at the Rib Room.
For reservations, call the Rib Room at the Hotel Sonesta.
You're listening to the Golden Age of Radio. This is Dick Bertel.
And this is Ed Corcoran.
And you're listening to WTIC in Hartford, Connecticut. Our show originating on tape from Weston, Connecticut this evening. And our guest, William Spear, the producer, director, and editor of Suspense. And one of the most charming people who ever appeared on Suspense was your lovely wife, Bill, and we haven't mentioned her at all, and I want her to sit down next to you and chat with us because she certainly is familiar to all of our listeners, I know. June Havoc, it is a pleasure to welcome you to this show.
Thank you. We've been together on television, haven't we?
We certainly have. We did a show last winter, I guess it was,
yes,
on the work that you're doing in Bridgeport.
Youth Bridge.
And
yes.
I guess you're still very much active in that, aren't you?
Yes, indeed.
Bringing theater to people, young people especially, who ordinarily would not be exposed to theater.
Right.
Well, let's talk about your radio career, June. And Bill, I want to get you in on this because you certainly work together. Something that I never realized was that June Havoc appeared on any number of your shows and was never given any credit. Now tell me why that was. Maybe June, maybe you want to.
June,
I'd
you better
love
tell
to
him.
Tell. Right. I got all the credit in the world. I got taken to dinner every night. I got wooed. I got an engagement ring and a wedding ring out of it. So I got plenty out of it. Yes, I got a marvelous man out of it, a brilliant man. And 23 years, he'll say it's 24. Don't listen to him.
Coming up.
But it is coming up, 24 years of marriage. And No, in those days, as a star, a film actress at the time, what I would do when I did a radio show was you would appear and it would all be very posh and your agent would be standing by and you'd have a special microphone of your very own and then you'd have all sorts of marvelous treatment and the really marvelous radio actors would be way over there surrounding one microphone. And I did that, you know, whenever one did a radio show and then eventually when I got to know Bill well enough to be asked out and asked for dinner, he was doing Suspense and Sam Spade, and he'd say, why don't you sit in the booth with me? And when I'm through doing the show, we'll go and dine. So I sat in the booth long enough to envy those actors. He's a wonderful, wonderful, marvelous director. And so I asked him one night, I batted my eyelashes and asked him if he would let me be one of the anonymous actors, because they didn't get billing. They're just marvelous. They're all stars today.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And after a while, they did accept me, but it was pretty rough, the producer-director girl sitting in there taking a job from somebody when she didn't need it, you know. But it worked, and I learned a great deal. And I played toothless old hags and Chinese people, and I played myself twice. I was twins once.
Really?
I murdered myself. It was very difficult. It was a challenge.
We have never had this opportunity on the program to ask a stage star and a motion picture star how she adapted to radio. Was it difficult for you at first?
Yes. It's an entirely different medium. And I originated, as you know, probably on the stage. And when I first did my first film acting, I was in a... I've never been very good at it. It's not my medium. And then television is even more difficult. That's not my medium either. I prefer the stage. You know, it's very simple, isn't it, to hear me say that. Radio was the closest to what I really loved.
Mm-hmm.
I remember that I used to have a radio set in every room, and I would tune in on my days when I was allowed to be home, not at the studio, on my favorite programs, and go from room to room doing whatever I had to accomplish, and I never left those people, and I used my imagination. They were in my mind's eye, and my mind's eye was sufficient for me at the time. It created wonderful vistas for me, which, of course, television limits me. I must see them. I must see what they're doing, and I must see it their way. I love television for other reasons, to watch.
Well, you know, the feeling that that I have about radio is that when television came in, Bill, people thought it was simply another dimension of radio, and Suspense was one of the first shows to make the transition to television, I'm sure you recall. But it really wasn't. It was a separate medium, and so was radio. Radio was unique. And radio, as we're talking about it tonight, is gone. Now, how do you feel about that? Is someone at fault?
That's a very, very tough one. I don't know. I suppose it comes down to a criticism of networks, or networks certainly had to make a choice there. You can't be both listening to the radio and looking at the television, and I suppose they put their money on the chips of television at the time. I've always wondered why it had to be, but I guess that's it. There's just so many hours in the day. But the housewife could listen to radio and still wash the dishes, but you can't look at television and do anything else.
But you don't have to wash the dishes anymore, Bill. That's true. I put them in that box there and turn the button on.
You've got to turn that button on anyway. You can't even do that.
Let's go back to June's radio career.
Yes, June, you did appear not only in Suspense because you had an inside track, but
oh no, that
you would have anyway.
Before.
But on your own, let's say, you did make it, and such shows as the Theater Guild on the Air, is that right, and many others.
Oh, I did it. Lux, I did everything. I did all the radio shows at the time. I was a film star at the time, so radio was easy for me to do if I had the time to do it.
Yeah, I think I mentioned to you, I have one of your films, you know. I have a few modest
will
ones.
Will you please, we won't discuss that.
Wouldn't you want to
we will not discuss that film.
You don't
film.
Care to go into your film career.
No,
in
my
time.
Film career, I have done, what is it, 39 films as of this date. And if the gods smile at me, I shall never appear on celluloid again or have to act in television again. That would be the happiest thing could happen to me.
Well, did you find that when you did go on to radio that it did require a different set of values or different techniques than you
different
used
techniques.
In your other career?
Different techniques in all the careers.
How did you like doing some of these oddball parts like you mentioned?
That was my favorite time of my life. I loved all that. I was a born character actress.
Actually, June's vocal equipment is fantastic as pretty much all of our equipment is.
What characterization is June going to do for us now?
Oh, no, those were a long time.
No, I'm not going to put you on the spot. We're going to listen to one of those shows.
Yeah, we have one of your shows, June, from the Suspense series that we were able to pick up here.
It was the one with Charles Laughton?
Oh, yes, with Charles
Laughton. You co-starred with Charles Laughton, right. Gentleman Caller.
Yeah, that's right. Oh, that's a grisly one. That'll scare you. It just scares me. Do I have to listen to that? It frightens me to pieces.
Well, why don't you go in the other room while we play it?
The DeMarcos and Mamie had said goodbye. That left me alone backstage. I'm always late anyway. 8 acts on the bill, and I'm always the last to leave the theater. Say, just what do you mean coming into a lady's dressing room without knocking?
Hi, cutie.
I never heard of a call boy who didn't know how to say, are you decent?
Oh, relax. Take it easy. We can't all be double-jointed.
All right, what do you want?
He's outside.
Who is outside?
Some John you won't like, says he's got a date with you. Oh, baby, you're closing tonight. Tomorrow you'll be in far-off Detroit. Then you'll wish you'd done the loop with me once. Come on, let you and me do our own circuit tonight.
I have a date, thank you.
Oh.
And will you go out and tell him to come in, if you please?
You can do better than him.
Yeah?
Yeah, me.
Oh,
you know, you got real talent, honey. You need somebody to watch out for you.
Get out of here!
Okay. Your stage door Johnny ain't gonna be no improvement. Believe me.
The idea, the very idea. Doggone it, where did I put that?
I believe I'm on time. The clock on the Wrigley Tower has just struck 11. I'm Vincent Hawthorne.
Oh.
I'm not what you expected, of course.
Well, I'll... Won't you come in, Mr.
Hawthorne.
Here, let me take your hat, Mr. Hawthorne.
Thank you.
I'll only be a minute. I'm leaving Chicago. I close tonight, you know. Detroit tomorrow. I was delayed at packing and all. I'm not quite dressed. Well, that's props anyway.
A theatrical trunk. This is a big thrill to me. Gloria LaFay. Theater. Rush. Gloria LaFay. Trends in bends.
Yeah, that's me.
Well, well, this is my first experience in meeting an artist.
Well, really?
Gloria. It's a lovely name, Gloria. It fits you. You're a very lovely girl. She had a woman's mouth with all its pearls complete. And for her eyes, what could such eyes do there but weep and weep that they were born so fair?
Huh? Well, it's something of your own.
Oh, I only wish it were. That's a narrative poem of Keats about a woman who turned into a serpent.
Well, gee, that's a cheerful little earful, I must say. And what do you got there?
That's a flower, a rose for you, here.
Oh, well, thanks. Yeah, I like roses.
I thought it'd look nice in your hair, Gloria.
Oh, yeah, well, thanks. Thanks a lot. That's real nice.
For your hair, yes.
Yeah, thanks.
And this. Now, this is something for both of us.
Is that whiskey?
No, hardly. It's wine. It's Chablis. It is a fine bouquet. Should lend a note of cheer to our little dressing room, hmm? And two glasses. Gee, I thought of everything. Fine wine should always be sipped from crystal, don't you think?
I plan on going out. And then...
Oh, yes, certainly, but I thought...
I'll only be a minute. I'll finish dressing behind the screen. Same, Mr. Hawthorne.
Oh, yes?
What's your first name?
Vincent, my dear.
Oh, say, Vincent.
Oh, thank you.
Vincent, just so we get everything clear on both sides, it's a funny situation, you see, because I don't quite know
how to... Are you concerned because we are having what is called a blind date?
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, you were in my mind. I just wanted it to be understood on both sides that I am not in the habit.
Of course not.
But lately, I've been thinking that after all, how is an artiste like myself, who spent practically all her life training for a profession and then finally goes out on the road since vaudeville's coming back now, you know, how's she ever going to meet people?
Yes.
You get the point?
Certainly. Of course, I understand that completely. We'll just have our little midnight supper.
I was coming to that. Say, where do you live?
I was born in London.
London? We were thinking about playing Australia once.
London is a great many miles from Australia, Gloria.
Gee, I'd sure like to get over to London. They say Australia's
London
great.
Is a very lonely place.
Palladium, I'll bet that's the biggest.
It's full of lonely people.
Oh, say, let's not...
The world is full of lonely people, Gloria. In your short lifetime, has that fact come to your attention?
Well, really, that kind of talk can ruin an evening. If you're going to talk like that, I don't know about us. Well, here we... Hey, what are you doing? Put away that knife.
I'm just opening our bottle, Gloria.
Well, I told you, I don't want to drink here. I want to go to Gregory's. Come on. Come on, let's put the show on the road.
Well, here's one for the road. A little glass of wine will do us both good.
No. I don't like the looks of that knife. Nobody needs a knife that big to open a bottle with.
This is a trick knife, see? You press the little button and the knife's gone just like that. It disappears into the handle.
Well, I don't like it. People get hurt with knives.
No, you're wrong. You're wrong about that. People get... A knife's a very handy instrument.
Oh.
You know, a good knife is hard to find. A good knife is a friend, Gloria. The only friend you can depend on sometimes. They say steel is cold, but it's really warm. It's warm as the human body.
And there we were. In the dressing room. Backstage in that empty theater. Mr. Hawthorne, his knife, and me.
Well, that's just an excerpt of that particular story with June Havoc and, of course, Charles Laughton, whose voice is unmistakable also.
It's one of my favorites, too.
Why don't you bring back radio, gentlemen?
We are right here on this very program.
History is being made tonight, yes.
I'll do an hour for a week for free, gladly, anytime. I will. It's an offer.
Then I'll join him.
Oh, wonderful.
Well, that's the start of an Arthur Repertory Company.
All right, let's do just that. Now, you've been mentioning Sam Spade, and we haven't really talked about Sam Spade as yet, Bill. Perhaps we can start at the beginning of this series. How did this one come about?
Well, Sam Spade is, I know you know, the detective of Dashiell Hammett. He is the hero of The Maltese Falcon.
Right.
The opening line in The Maltese Falcon of the novel is, "My name is Sam Spade," which, how better writing than that can there be from Hammett? Because he doesn't fool around. There's no waste of time. Lawrence White, who had been Dashiell Hammett's agent for a great many years, had always wanted me to do Sam Spade. In one way or the other, but I had always been too busy. But it came at the exact right moment somehow. One day he said, "Now how about Sam Spade?" After I was well launched into suspense many years. And I said, sure, let's do it. The original plan had been for us possibly to use Humphrey Bogart, who had played Sam Spade, of course, in the most famous version there ever will be of Sam Spade in movies. And Bogey perhaps would have been available. He would have cost us at that time $3,000 a week, which in radio was, and certainly is, but was big money. This whole Sam Spade show, the whole suspense show, never cost over $5,000 or $6,000. I said, no, I foresee, adding all the things up on one side or the other, that it would be better for us to find an unknown and start with him than be settled to a star, great as he is, who's going to be going into movies, who's going to be back and forth, there's going to be trouble, he's going to leave for Africa when you must not want to do next week's show. And we didn't tape things then. There were no, you had to do them live every week. And I found Howard Duff, who had played numerous parts and, you know, in the cast of Suspense and other shows that I did. We did the audition, and it was sold, I think, within 48 hours. I was very hot, if I do say so, at the time, and they were waiting for a show from me, and Philip Morris bought it, and Sam Spade got started. It went 6 years, and then was one of the victims of the assassination of radio, plus complicating factors in the unjust, completely unjust, polarizing of Dashiell Hammett, who had been thought to have been with communist leanings, which he was not, so far as I know, and so the show was disappeared. I was in Europe at the time. We recorded it in advance, transcriptions, and I was in Europe. June and I were on a trip there, and I heard from Larry White that Sam Spade had been canceled. And I thought, well, it's not too bad that I suppose that Philip Morris or whoever it was ran out of the budget, changed or something. But it'll be sold in an hour because it was a very successful show. Always in the first 10. And 2 weeks, 3 weeks went by, and there was still nobody, no takers. And I didn't find out till I got back to this country that there had been those complications. And by the time they were able to be cleared out at all, radio was disappearing to the east.
I think most people associate Wildroot as being the sponsor.
Well, Wildroot, of course, you're right. That's right.
The excerpt we have tonight is with the Wildroot commercial intact.
Yes, I see. Good.
You like to hear it?
Love to.
The Adventures of Sam Spade, Detective. Brought to you by Wildroot Cream Oil Hair Tonic, the non-alcoholic hair tonic that contains lanolin. Wildroot Cream Oil, again and again, the choice of men who put good grooming first.
Detective agency.
That is the correct answer. You have just won $104 million, 6 deep freeze units, a stable of polo ponies with matching saddle soap, a terry cloth robe with chocolate bars pre-melted into the pockets, and a full-size, real, honest-to-goodness dreadnought, such as is used by Uncle Sam's Navy.
Oh, I'm sorry you'll have to call back. I'm expecting to be taking dictation from my employer very shortly.
Oh, I am sorry. Your time is up. And Edna St. Vincent Markowitz, who sent in the question, gets bumped off in front of the studio audience gathered in the Dredgewood Room here in Columbia Square. Next night, don't answer your phone, stupid.
Oh, Sam.
Let's have no coaching, please.
Oh, well, did you find the cop? Was it murder? Was it really worth, well, you know, priceless and like that, and was it fun?
Yes, 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 and no. And finally, are you kidding?
Well, then why was it called the Vapio Cup?
It's a very old Greek expression, which is what I'll be wearing as I sit in your lap dictating my report on the Vapio Cup caper.
Dashiell Hammett, America's leading detective fiction writer and creator of Sam Spade, the hard-boiled private eye, and William Spear, radio's outstanding producer-director of mystery and crime drama, join their talents to make your hair stand on end with the adventures of Sam Spade. Presented by the makers of Wildroot Cream Oil for the hair. And now, with Howard Duff starring as Spade, Wildroot brings to the air the greatest private detective of them all in the adventures of Sam Spade.
Sam Spade, another creation of William Spear. Tonight's program is being brought to you by Hotel Sonesta at Constitution Plaza in Hartford, Connecticut. And sharing this evening of memories with me once again is Jim Ballard, general manager of the Hotel Sonesta. And Jim, let's talk about the entirely new and exciting dinner menu at the Rib Room. And I do mean exciting. This is exciting not only as far as taste is concerned,
But the visual impact is also thrilling.
It is, Dick, and it's really no great mystery. It's fine dining with flaming steak Diane, flaming beef kebab, and one of our real specialties is the flaming Spanish coffee after your dinner.
I understand. That is exciting. I think that any food prepared tableside is thrilling for anybody to see, and you just don't have that opportunity today. At least you didn't have until this new and exciting dinner menu was inaugurated at the Rib Room.
I think it's given a real rebirth to the Rib Room, the exciting menu and, as you indicated, preparation tableside.
Now, you might order something which, let's say, is flaming. The person next to you may order something which you can enjoy watching the preparation of at the same time. You don't necessarily have to confine it to your own foods or likes, do you?
No, you do not.
Now, this is available 6 nights a week?
Yes, it is, Monday through Saturday.
And we certainly urge everyone who hasn't had the opportunity to visit the Rib Room to do so. The Rib Room is located in the Hotel Sonesta on Constitution Plaza here in downtown Hartford. And remember, parking is free. Well, Jim, shall we return to suspense?
Let's.
All right. Now, I know that you have a favorite story, Ed, from your collection. How many suspense stories do you have?
Well, I estimate around 200, Dick, and there are more coming in all the time. The one that I would say, if I took a poll among all the people who collect these shows, this one would win the top honor. It's called A House in Cypress Canyon, with a very good cast, Robert Taylor, Kathy Lewis, Hans Conried, and the aforementioned Sam Spade, who, of course, is Howard Duff.
That was a very good show, I recall. It was, The House in Cypress Canyon was written by Robert L. Richards, a very, very fine writer who, by the way, I first met at the March of Time. He was one of the editors from Time magazine then, and he came out to the coast and got into this. That was a show that was a little different from most of the ones we did. The notion was that you can't tell where you begin and if what has happened is a figment of the man's imagination or not, because the things all fall into place, and just when you think, aha, that's it, it starts over again and seems to be going around in a circle.
Okay, why don't we play that, Dick? And I think everybody remember Robert Taylor, who passed away just last year, but this was really one of his best radio performances.
The House in Cypress Canyon.
Well, it was one of those things. The real estate agent had just been authorized to rent the place by mail that morning, and he'd hardly had time to look at it himself and put up his sign when we drove up. It was just an ordinary little California house about halfway up Cypress Canyon, number 2256. Just an ordinary, undistinguished little house. It wasn't the best place in the world. It was small and badly built, but what would you have done? We took it with as little inspection as that. It was the Saturday before Christmas. And the very same evening, we were struggling up the steps from the road with suitcases and boxes and armloads of clothes and all the endless bric-a-brac that people collect and never know they have until they move. Ellen began unpacking, and I began moving things around and taking the worst of the pictures off the wall, doing all the little things that everybody does when they move into a new place and try to give it something of their own personality.
Don't be such a sourpuss. You know, it's a roof over our heads for Christmas. That's more than we ever thought we'd get, isn't it? Jim, I think red curtains are what we need, don't you?
Mm-hmm. Mm.
You know, just at least for the living room. Anyway, the ones in there now have just got to come down.
Yeah, I suppose they do.
What do you think of red?
Well, I guess it's all...
Jim.
That's some tomcat.
Jim, it sounded... in the house.
Oh, now, how could it be in the house, Ellen? We've been over every inch of the house.
Except that closet.
Now, how could a cat or anything else be in the closet that's been locked up for over a year?
Oh, I don't know.
It's probably under the house. A wildcat or mountain lion or something. I hear they have them in California.
Jim, I don't like
it. Well, neither do I like it, but there's nothing we can do about it tonight.
Well, maybe we ought to call somebody, the police or some neighbor.
Oh, don't be silly, Ellen. You act like a kid. Come on, let's go to bed, huh? I don't know what time it was, perhaps an hour, perhaps only a half hour later. My mind was in that hazy borderland between sleep and a dream that's still part of consciousness. Then I was awake. Ellen, are you all right?
Yes.
Did you have a nightmare or something?
No. I heard it, too.
Well, that didn't sound like any cat.
Put on the light.
Yeah.
It seemed to be out there, Jim, in the house somewhere.
Well, I'm going to look into this.
Jim, you be careful.
Come on. Where's my shotgun?
In the den, I think. Jim.
What?
There's something wet.
What? Wet?
Running from under the closet door. Sticky.
Ellen, don't. Don't touch it.
I had to. Jim, it's blood.
It cannot be too difficult to understand from the foregoing why I've taken the pains to set down in writing the events related here. To find in one's newly rented house a closet which cannot be opened is in itself certainly no great cause for alarm. But to be awakened in the stillness of the night by unearthly cries within that house, to find oozing from under that closet door something that is unquestionably blood, that's another matter. Perhaps others might have been braver than we. Suffice it only to say that we got out of the house in something very close to a panic, and only returned when we had the moral support of two stalwart Los Angeles policemen.
You just moved in here, you say?
That's right, officer. You can see we're still unpacking.
Where is this closet?
Oh, it's right in here, officer. And the blood is...
Where? Where's the blood?
Jim?
Officer, I swear to you, there was blood on the floor less than an hour ago. I saw it.
Uh-huh.
It was running out from under that door. We heard that noise and we got up and then we saw it. The door was locked.
Locked, huh?
Oh, no.
There's nothing wrong with this closet. Walls are solid. No trap doors.
If you think I'm lying...
I didn't say that, mister. Oh, you probably did hear some sort of noise and you got a little panicky.
What about the blood? It got on my hand.
Isn't there now, is it?
Yes.
Where?
I feel it.
It was sometime after midnight when I was suddenly wide awake and staring into the darkness. In some way, I knew at once and instinctively what had awakened me. Ellen was not in her bed nor in the room. It must have been a full minute that I stood before that closet door. Then I opened it. She stood there rigid, her arms at her sides, the fingers extended like claws. Her hair was over her face, her eyes stared out of it. Her lips were drawn back in a grin like an animal at bay. For a moment, I was frozen with the horror of it. I stretched out my hand. Very deliberately, she turned her head and sunk her teeth until they met into the flesh of my forearm. I'd raised my hand to strike at her, but already she'd relaxed her hold and gone utterly limp. She would have fallen unless I'd caught her. I carried her into the bedroom and laid her on the bed. Strangely, at that moment, my only thought was how I might revive her. Until I saw that it was not a faint, but a sleep that she'd fallen into. A sleep as deep and heavy as though she'd been drugged.
We'll be back to our guest, Bill Spear, right after this message.
Jim Ballard is with me. Jim is general manager of the Hotel Sonesta, our sponsors tonight. Jim, the Festival of Light takes place starting this coming Friday, and this is an opportunity to visit the rendezvous room of the Hotel Sonesta.
Yes, the rendezvous, Dick, as you know, overlooks the magnificent plaza and is certainly a delightful spot to sit and sip one's favorite drink.
You know how cold it is out there on the plaza during Christmas time, so come down, see the lights, and then visit the rendezvous room. Also enjoy music by Men of the Sun, starting at 9 o'clock. What about New Year's Eve parties, Jim?
On New Year's Eve, Dick, we'll be featuring parties in our Plaza Room, Men of the Sun plus Connie Jackson, the Carlton Room, Lou Hansen and his orchestra, the rendezvous, and we will also be serving New Year's Eve dinner in the Rib Room, all featuring free parking.
Reservations are, of course, needed and should be obtained now.
Yes, I would suggest.
All right. Jim, did you enjoy listening to these radio memories tonight as much as I did?
I certainly did, Dick, and I want to thank you sincerely for letting me sit here with you and join in this delightful program.
Now, let's get back to our guest, William Spear.
Well, Bill, let's bring our audience up to date as to what you're doing. You're in the process of writing currently. Of course, you're not writing for radio, are you?
No, I wish I were. Actually, I never wrote nearly as much as I'd like to. I was a producer and director and a great rewriter. Right now, I'm playing hooky to a considerable degree, but I'm working sporadically on a novel or two, but I'm so thrown by the fact that nobody's waiting for it, as with all my years of radio, when people would say, what are you working on now? You'd say, well, I'm working on next Thursday's show. Well, I haven't got any show to do for next Thursday, and so I'm kind of baffled as to what would I like to write. And so I guess I'm using that old writer's trick of not writing anything by looking out the window saying, what would I like to write?
You'd better get a deadline. That's what you need.
We've been visiting at the Weston, Connecticut home of radio producer William Spear and his charming wife, June Havoc, as we relived memories of the past on the golden age of radio. My thanks to co-host Ed Corcoran for the exciting excerpts we heard tonight. The Golden Age of Radio was brought to you by Hotel Sonesta at Constitution Plaza, Hartford. Recording and technical supervision by Bob Schirego. The program was produced and edited by Brian Hartnett. This is Dick Bertel.
Mexico service stations and dealers in all our 48 states present for your entertainment Eddie Duchin and his music. Graham McNamee. And Ed Wynn, the fire chief.